One of my favorite quotes is by Mark Twain. And Mark Twain said, "It's much easier to fool people than it is to convince people that they've been fooled." Well, today we're going to talk about some very interesting lessons about COVID-19 and dare to ask the question, on a number of issues, have we been fooled? And with us to help discern this truth is one of my heroes, Dr. Martin Kulldorff.
A clear path forward requires looking back and learning. Good public policy requires human connection. It's a consideration of the facts, applying common sense and innovation. It's urban, it's rural, it's real life. We all have something to contribute. We all have a responsibility to get informed because there's a little piece of Canada in all of us, isn't there? Let's learn on this path together. This is Leaders on the Frontier.
Okay, so a warm welcome to you, Dr. Martin Kulldorff. Thank you very much for joining this conversation today.
Thank you.
Well, Martin, you have a long history as a biostatistician. You're certainly one of the world's leading authorities around vaccines and their efficacy, and certainly on pandemics. And you're also a professor at the Harvard Medical School. So we're really grateful that you could join us. And I know one of the things that I still celebrate is your leadership, along with Dr. Jay Bhattacharya at Stanford, and of course, Dr. Sunita Gupta at Oxford. As you came together, it's hard to believe, on October 4th, 2020, and you wrote and declared the so-called Great Barrington Declaration, which was really, I think, was a landmark document that called for, is it fair to say, best practices when it came to medicine regarding the COVID-19 challenge. Can you explain to people what that declaration was about?
Yeah, it called for following the basic principles of public health. And one of those basic principles is that you cannot only be concerned about one disease, you're concerned about health as a whole, all kinds of cancer, cardiovascular, mental health, and not just today, but also for the future, and not just in a small group of people, but for the population at whole. So that's different from a medical doctor. If you go to your medical doctor, he or she is concerned about the one particular disease that you have at the moment and you. But public health is much broader than that. So the emphasis on COVID, where we used ineffective measures like lockdown, that had enormous collateral public health damage because people didn't get their cancer screening or treatment or their treatment for cardiovascular disease, mental health was deteriorating, diabetes, and so on. And of course, schools closing here in the US have had major impact, negative impact on children. So the
Well,
collateral
and
damage
I
from these lockdowns have been enormous.
they really have been incredible, the damage done by lockdowns and the response, looking back. And certainly today we're going to have a far-reaching conversations about those lessons learned. And so I think the Great Barrington Declaration is a very landmark declaration regarding best practices regarding human health, as you say. And I think part of the context then was, and it was fascinating because I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned here. During that time, the assertion by many authorities and governments across the Western world was that there was a consensus on the efficacy of these lockdowns. There was a consensus on so many things in retrospect that we realized weren't true. So I thought that the Great Barrington Declaration made a huge positive difference because you basically weighed in as key leaders in your fields. It was very hard to disagree with it. And I believe you have well over a million signatures, and you can see it online. So you really broke that message that wasn't really getting through, that there's some kind of consensus. Is that right, Martin?
Yeah, there's just shy of a million signatures. But so many of us tried to speak up from the very beginning in the spring of 2020. But I wasn't able to publish in the US about this, arguing for focus protection, where you protect older people better while letting children and young people live their lives. I was able to publish in my native Sweden, but not in the U.S.
And no, other wait a second. You mean you had this opinion that there was not a consensus, that there was important information from a professional medical point of view that you wanted to share, but you couldn't publish that, Martin. Why?
I sent it to various publications, some more scientific and some more general, and they didn't want it. Mm-hmm. They don't want to hear this alternative message. And there were other people who tried to speak up, but most of our scientists who tried to speak up had a very hard time doing it. So,
wow.
And if somebody said something, they would sort of say, oh, there's just one person, or that person is not in the relevant field. So with the Great Barrington Declaration, the fact that there were three of us made a difference. We were all had worked in infectious disease technology for a long time, so they couldn't claim that we were not in the field. And we were all from three reasonably respectable universities, Harvard, Stanford, and Oxford. So it became impossible for them then to ignore. So they have pretended that there was a consensus, but there never was. And when I talked personally to my colleagues, the majority agreed with us that we shouldn't lock down and that we should have so focus on the vulnerable, those at high risk, which were the older people. But many were afraid of speaking up also, and I understand why. Because if you spoke up, there were consequences.
Wow. So this is a very important lesson. And in retrospect, what you stated with Dr. Jay Bhattacharya and Dr. Sunita Gupta were essentially true. And yet you were vilified. In fact, in retrospect, we found all kinds of emails from people like the senior government officials consciously going after you guys, vilifying you, slandering you. In fact, it's really quite disturbing. And so there's lessons to be learned from that, aren't there, Martin?
Yeah, and I think one lesson is freedom of speech is a foundational pillar of civilization. And we have to protect that with everything we can. And secondly, for science to operate, there needs to be a public, polite, but polite debate. It can be very passionate. That's good. But there has to be a debate. So if there are different scientists with different perspectives, then that has to be discussed in open and not do like the NIH director at the United States, the National Institute of Health, which is the biggest medical research agency, who thought we were fringe epidemiologists and asked for a devastating takedown. He should instead have sponsored the discussions and debates. That was his job, which he didn't do. Instead, he tried to squash anything that opposed what he thought was the correct thing, which, of course, it wasn't.
Exactly. So bravo on you and the group for standing up for science and open discussion. And it wasn't certainly easy. So if we look back to when COVID-19 came on the scene, it seems like several years now. What was your initial reaction? You're a biostatistician, so you look at these stats very carefully. Were you concerned when COVID-19 came on the horizon?
Well, I was scared for about 10, 20 minutes. So
Ten or 20 minutes.
Yeah. So first of all, when I heard that there was the outbreaks in northern Italy and Iran, which were the two countries outside of China where it came first, it was clear to me, it was obvious that this will eventually reach the whole world. There was no way we could stop that from happening because we didn't know how it came into Italy or Iran. So it was sort of spreading in a stealth underground fashion. And when that's the case, there's no way you can stop it. Just like we can't stop the influenza that comes every year. It's impossible. So so that was clear. So that was, of course, concerning because I knew it would eventually arrive to me and my family and friends and everybody else. So then I quickly looked at the data from Wuhan. And at that time, we didn't know what the fatality rate was. But I look at the age distribution of those who had died in Wuhan, and then I found the age distribution for the population in Wuhan, and I compare that. So I did a back of the envelope calculation, and I found that while obviously anybody can get a virus, and presumably everybody is exposed to approximately the same amount, there was more than a thousandfold difference in the risk of dying from COVID, where the older people had more than a thousandfold higher risk than younger people. So this was clear that this was a disease that was dangerous for older people, but not for children. And like okay. most parents, I care more about my children, and I have three, age 20, they were then age 17, 4, and 4. But as most parents, I care more about their lives than I care about mine. So it was obvious then that, okay, my kids were going to be fine. Other children were going to be fine. We didn't have to worry about that. What we had to worry about is we'll have to try to put in something in place to protect older people because they are the ones who are at risk from this virus. And then once it has gone through society, then we have some form of herd immunity, and then everybody can go back to living normal lives.
Okay, so you figured this out fairly quickly, given your expertise and experience in these matters. And you basically said that natural immunity will work its course through the population, but there is a particular profile of people that this COVID-19 was a concern for. They were at risk, and you said that profile was older persons with larger health concerns. Is that a fair comment?
I would say that everybody in their 70s or 80s, 90s, and so on should be concerned. But of course, those who are frail are at even higher risk.
Okay. So your kind of risk assessment that you did a number of years ago, have those facts borne out? Have they withstood scrutiny? Is that still accurate?
Yes, we know now for sure that we know that it was more than a thousandfold difference in risk between age groups. We know that children are at minuscule risk from minuscule risk from COVID and less risk from COVID than an average influenza season, because every year some kids die from influenza. The one country that implemented a focused protection of not closing all the schools, and et cetera, and restaurants and businesses was Sweden.
Sweden, it's clear that they did it right. Is that a fair comment?
Yeah, so what matters is if people die or not. And you can look at all-cause mortality, which is numbers that are very difficult to fudge. And if we compare the excess mortality, so you compare the mortality from 2020 and the next 3 or 4 years, and you compare that with what would have been expected based on previous years. And Sweden has the lowest excess mortality among Western countries.
Sorry, Sweden has the lowest all-cause mortality rate in the Western countries, including Canada?
Yes. And in terms of COVID mortality, Sweden is on the lower, but not the very lowest. But if you do all-cause mortality, so what happened is that Sweden has lower than average COVID mortality, despite not locking down. So lockdown didn't do much for COVID. But then Sweden doesn't have this collateral damage on cancer and cardiovascular disease, etc., or mental health conditions. So, that's proof that Sweden was heavily criticized, and newspapers and politicians were complaining and said that they were irresponsible and so on. And it turns out that they knew what they were doing because they were following basic principles of public health.
Indeed. Yeah. So I recall that well, certainly in conversation with yourself and others, that Sweden was just utterly criticized left and right as being an outlier, as being somehow abnormal, extreme. There were all kinds of words that people threw at them, but they were right. There's no doubt about that. Is that correct, yeah, Martin?
That's correct. And the data is in now. So, I mean, I knew that it was the right thing 4 years ago, but I understand that if you don't know epidemiology, then it's easy. And I don't think you should blame people for being fooled here, because mm-hmm. you should blame the epidemiologists who did not, or the leading scientists and mm-hmm. the politicians who didn't get this right. But you can't blame regular people, because they don't. I mean, if I was a chemist or a plumber or a fireman or something, I wouldn't have known. Mm-hmm. Except actually they did know quite well. So if you mm-hmm. take the truckers in Canada, for example, they knew, and they're smart.
It is truly remarkable.
Regular people knew better this than the heads of the universities and the politicians mm-hmm. and the mm-hmm. journalists.
No, it's a stunning story in retrospect. So we need to remember history. We need to learn lessons from this. And so if we had to do this again, let's look to Sweden as that kind of example of best practices of public health. There were a lot of other assertions made, and I don't know where to begin. There were so many of them regarding mask wearing as an example. And you know, it's hard to see people with masks now, and one never knows their particular situation, so one has to be compassionate. But they used a lot of fear to institute a lot of public health orders in retrospect that are shown in retrospect to be utterly wrong. So we talked about the whole efficacy of lockdowns as an example, but if you look at mask wearing or there's a whole host of other things. Are there good examples that we can again learn from, Martin, in retrospect?
Well, with masks, I mean, we should look at the high quality studies that were done on mask efficacy. And there were two, the best studies are randomized trials, and there were two of them. Mm-hmm. And one was done in Denmark, showing if mask wearing protected the person wearing the mask, and found that it had no effect or minimal effect. There was no statistically significant effect of them. Mm-hmm. Then there was another study in Bangladesh where there was a very neat study, because they randomized not individuals by villages, because that way they could see if the mask not only protected the person wearing it, but also if it protected other people in the village. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it was a good design, and they found that the infections were reduced somewhere between 0 and 18%, which means mm-hmm. not at all or minuscule. So we know that masks, either they don't work or they work to a very limited extent. And when that's the case, it's actually very dangerous to tell people to wear a mask and you'll be safe, or the mask will protect you, because then if you're 80 years old, you'll go out to that crowded restaurant and you think that the mask is protecting you, and it's not. So this false message of making people think that they were protected by the mask actually, I think, killed people.
Wow. Isn't that sad? So, I mean, I think the other point that I notice is beyond the message of fear that a lot of public health authorities led with was the whole issue of why would we not encourage people to be healthy, to actually get outside, to exercise, to eat well. You didn't really hear that message or even be open in conversation with your physician about alternative remedies. We never heard that, did we, Martin?
Yeah, that was the opposite, because they closed the beaches, they closed the basketball courts, they closed playgrounds for kids, which was completely ridiculous nonsense. Mm-hmm. We know that exercise and good food helps with the immune system. Mm-hmm. So if we know that the mm-hmm. virus is going to come, then we should encourage people to be healthy and eat mm-hmm. well and be out exercise. No, that's not going to. That's not like a
fail-proof
system, but it's one thing that we always should do, and even more during the pandemic. So,
mm-hmm.
so well, to close this, this close this ability to be outside, where there's a natural risk from getting the virus, and good opportunity for running or bicycling or canoeing or whatever is person's favorite thing mm-hmm. to do, that was very, very bad public health messaging.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think in retrospect, I think what I found fascinating is the inherent contradiction around the approach to lockdowns is that you could go to Walmart, you could go to the liquor store, but you couldn't go to important points of socialization and community support, like going to a church or a synagogue or a temple or anything like that. So and then to lock children away in, you know, away from schools really has put back children significantly in terms of their development in every way. I hear this all the time from teachers to this day, that there's a whole generation of children that literally have been put back at least a year or two in their development. It's very, very sad.
Yeah, you can see from the U.S. that they have studies where the test scores are going down, went down, and they are now slowly trying to creep up again. So, and that's the contrast to Sweden, where there's no such effect.
It is really remarkable.
And education, we know education is important for lifelong well-being, including the being healthy. So, and that was actually one of the arguments that Anders Tegnell, who is the chief epidemiologist that in Sweden, used for not closing schools, that there are long-term negative health effects of closing schools. That was one of the arguments he used. And of course, indeed. So we know the test score are down, but I mean, it's also the mental health of children and their social skills, which are equally important. So if I could change another one thing with how I was done with the pandemic, it would have been to keep the schools open. If I can only change one thing, that's the one thing I would have picked.
Interesting. So one of the key mistakes was closing schools. Yep. Well said. So I did want to talk with you as well. There's a famous quote by a virologist who said, since the Athenian plague in 430 BC, we have known about natural immunity. So it's strange that suddenly that this is under discussion. I think that was your quote, Martin Kulldorff. Can you tell us about natural immunity? I mean, that was remarkable because you had the different authorities, including the director of the CDC. I remember this distinctly. I think it was back in 2019, arguing that natural immunity was really not the way to go. I mean, this is just stunning in retrospect, is it not, Martin?
Yes, so we have known since the Athenian plague 2,500 years ago that if you survive an infectious disease, then you have immunity, natural immunity or infection acquired immunity that will protect you the second time you get infected. For some diseases like measles, that's lifelong protection. For other diseases like the coronaviruses, including those previous one and the current one, is not a lifelong. You can get sick again, but the first time is when it's risky, and the subsequent times you sort of deal with, you can get a little bit sick like a cold, but you deal with it much better. So it doesn't have the same risk the second and third and fourth time around and so on. So we have known about that. So the fact that people are starting to question this is quite amazing, including by very prominent scientists. So, and when, for example, university professors, when they institute vaccine mandates for people who have already had the disease, that's the de facto rejection of immune system. And to me, that's like having a university pressing question whether the earth is round or flat, or whether gravity exists or not. I mean, it's the same kind of a basic scientific knowledge that we have known for so long and that was accepted until from 230 BC until 2019, and then from 2020 to 2020 well, for a few years. And now I think people are recognizing it again. And the same thing, people were claiming, like CDC, and the CDC director was claiming that you had better protection from the vaccine than from infection-acquired immunity. Wow. And they put out some very flawed study trying to prove that, but there were good studies, one from Israel, for example, that showed very clearly that while the vaccine does give some immune protection, it's not as good as those who have had COVID. That doesn't mean that you should try to get it, because if you have a dangerous disease and it's dangerous for older people, you can die from it. So the purpose of the vaccine is sort of to give you some of that protection without having to take the risk of getting the disease. So that's why vaccines are very good. For example, measles, or why it was very important for smallpox, etc. But to sort of claim that vaccines are better than infection-acquired immunity, that it gives you better immunity than infection-acquired immunity, that's very strange. And I mean, basically, the vaccine is there to mimic what the body does when it's infected. So it would be extremely surprising if the vaccine would ever be better than the immunity you have from having acquired it.
Exactly.
And again, if you believe in these vaccines that they save lives, then you should not vaccinate people who have already had it, because you're wasting vaccines on those that don't need it. At the same time, people around the world that haven't had COVID, and therefore they will get protection from the vaccine. So these vaccine mandates are not only are sort of unethical, they are unscientific, and they are unethical, because it forces people to take the vaccine that doesn't need it when there is a vaccine shortage.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, if I hear what you're saying, or understand what you're saying, is that if you appreciate vaccines, you understand the efficacy of natural immunity.
Yes, you should, at least.
I mean, this is basic medicine. So, yeah, wow. So we threw out basic medicine and from the Center for Disease Control, no less. So this is really raised a lot of questions and confidence about these institutions, and we'll get to that in a moment. But I did want to pick up the theme then about vaccines. So we know that these are a particular type of vaccines, and I'm asking you, Dr. Martin Koldorf, because you're one of the leading world authorities around vaccines. But are these really vaccines? Like it's very evident that these vaccines really didn't stop the transmission of this virus. So what the heck were they? And now we've also learned, at least in Canada, Health Canada has admitted that they're adulterated. They have contaminants in them of DNA. So there's a lot of questions regarding what the heck are these, quote, vaccines, Martin. Can you help us understand that?
So it's true that they did not prevent... So everybody who got the vaccine would eventually get COVID also. So that's true. Now, when they were approved in late 2020, December 2020, the randomized trials that was run by Pfizer and Moderna, they did not evaluate the important outcome, which is death or hospitalization. What they showed was...
Wait a sec. Can you repeat that? They did not evaluate what?
So the purpose of the vaccine is to prevent death and also to some extent hospitalizations. But the randomized trials did not evaluate whether they were able to do that. They evaluate whether they prevented symptomatic disease. And I don't want to be harsh, but I don't actually care if you... are sick for a few days and have to stay home from work and be in bed for a while. I care about you not dying and also not going to the hospital. That's good to avoid. But these randomized trials, they evaluated only symptomatic COVID disease. So they show that the mRNA vaccine had about a 95% efficacy in preventing symptomatic COVID disease for a few months, in short term. And then they stopped the trial. So now, you have to then say, okay, we don't really care about symptomatic disease, but if they prevent symptomatic disease, probably they will also prevent death, at least in older people. And they probably did that in 2021, is my guess, because we have observational data that show that. But we should have had randomized trials on that. In the spring of 2021, I answered a question on Twitter, which I was censored for, at the behest of the U.S. government directly, who was directly sort of the line of communication there. I said that vaccines are important for older, high-risk people, but you don't need it if you've already had COVID, and children don't need it either. And I think that was a true statement.
You were
then
asked by leaders in the U.S. government for opinion on this.
No, it was asked by a random person on Twitter.
Okay.
And I answered that older people benefit from the vaccine. This was in 2021. Mm-hmm. But if you don't need it if you already have had COVID, because you have infection-acquired immunity, and children don't need it either. And I was censored by that at the behest of the U.S. government.
Wow.
For saying that, I think is something that's
truly
completely true. It's completely true statement, what I said. And I think it's very hard to argue against it on any scientific grounds.
Okay, so I don't want to put words in your mouth, but the vaccines had some efficacy for a particular vulnerable population, namely older people, health concerns, for short-term benefits. Is that a fair comment then?
I would say so. So I think in the 2021, it did have benefit for older people. But we also know now that the efficacy of these vaccines wane very rapidly. The clinical trials didn't evaluate that, but we know from observational data that the efficacy of these vaccines wanes very, very fast.
But you know, clearly people have to talk with their physician. But if you've already had COVID-19, there really isn't, in general, any point to having the booster again. Is that a fair comment then?
Well, that's the decision that I've taken. But I'm not a physician, so I can't make any recommendations for specific people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's talk about the vaccines now, because obviously one of the big issues now that is people are very concerned about is the whole issue of vaccine injury. And I wanted to play this short clip of a story.
They suffered life-altering injuries after they got their COVID vaccine. Now, two BC men are facing another battle, the fight for compensation. They were approved for the federal money, but they're still waiting to be reimbursed tens of thousands of dollars. CTV's Michelle Bernaro has more.
2.5 years after a COVID-19 Pfizer vaccine injury, Julian Schofield continues to rely on a wheelchair to get around. And while he's seen some improvement,
I have pretty good mobility through my hips. I can crawl around on the floor.
There are new pains to endure.
I've gone through lots of nerve sensation and nerve pain. And it's been elevating over time, getting worse and worse.
Obviously, you can see they're kind of curled in and whatnot.
Ross Whiteman also faces ongoing physical struggles after developing a severe neurological disorder in April 2021 from the AstraZeneca vaccine.
I have some tremors now, shaking.
Both Whiteman and Schofield were approved for compensation through the Federal Vaccine Injury Support Program and have received payments. But both also say they are still owed tens of thousands of dollars in out-of-pocket medical expenses for things like the leg braces that allow Whiteman to walk.
They're anywhere between $1,000 to $1,500 each.
Or this elevator that Schofield had installed in his home so he could access the main living area.
It's really challenging to be in this situation in the first part and then to have to fight tooth and nail to get what they say they're going to provide. is completely demoralizing.
But they say their emails and calls for reimbursement mostly go unanswered.
It's the second case manager that I've had that has quit, and I was not notified that my case manager was no longer working there.
CTV News contacted the company that oversees Ottawa's compensation program, but did not hear back.
As of last month, more than 2,230 people have submitted claims to Canada's Vaccine Injury Support Program. The majority of those have been deemed admissible. However, so far, just 138 have been approved.
Meanwhile, both men say they need to focus their energy on adapting to their new life and healing instead of fighting for the help they were promised. Michelle Brunoro, CTV News, Vancouver.
So these are tragic stories of people injured by the vaccine. There's actually a vaccine compensation program at the federal level for this. And we all know anecdotally people that actually know who've been injured or claim to be injured by the vaccines. So this is pretty controversial, because the question then is, Dr. Karldorf, what are you seeing statistically? Like, these are examples of specific individuals, but is there a larger vaccine injury problem? I know that vaccines sometimes create injuries, but are you concerned that there's a lot of vaccine injuries in this country?
So first of all, I've been working on vaccine and drug safety for a few decades. So when there is a new drug or vaccine on the market, there are always risks involved with it. So when it comes to the COVID vaccine, if for older people who are at high risk, there's actually benefit from these vaccines to reduce deaths. And if that's the case, then you're willing to take a small risk from an adverse reaction. On the other hand, when you now go to middle-aged adults, young adults, and children who has a very small risk from dying from COVID, then even if there's a small risk from adverse reaction from the vaccine, the balance of the benefit risk goes in the other direction. So you don't want to give a drug or a vaccine to people who has very minimal, where the potential benefit is very minimal, because you don't know what the risks are. So it was irresponsible to do a mass vaccination campaign for children and young adults, because we can never know about exactly what the adverse reactions are from the randomized trials. So that's another reason why we should have focused the vaccines on those older people who were at high risk from COVID. So what do we know about the adverse reactions from the COVID vaccines? We know some things, for example, about myocarditis with inflammation of the heart. There has been many other reports, but as of yet, there hasn't been a full evaluation of the magnitude of the adverse reactions. That's possible to do. The data is will be available, and I'm sure it will be done eventually. But so far, we don't have great numbers on that. So we know there are some adverse reactions, but we don't know the full magnitude of it.
Okay. So there's a lot of angles to this, one of which is the mass vaccination approach didn't make sense because people outside those older age categories had extremely low risk with COVID-19. This is clear. So then meanwhile, you're incurring injuries on a younger population that didn't need to experience that. So that's is that what you're saying?
Yeah, if the potential benefit, it doesn't matter if it's this vaccine or some other drug, if the potential benefit is very, very small, then you don't want to take the risk, because there's always some risks. On the other hand, if you have cancer and there's a drug that can help with your cancer, then you can accept quite high adverse risk for adverse reactions. And some of the cancer drugs have quite high adverse reaction rates, but that's sort of an acceptable thing then. So You have to balance the benefit with the potential risks. And if the benefits are small, which we know they were for young people, then you shouldn't. Then it's not worthwhile taking the risk, which is still unknown.
Okay. So in general, it doesn't make sense, for instance, to vaccinate children because they're at such insignificant risk.
Yeah. For example, Harvard University still has a mandate for students to be vaccinated. These are young people.
I beg your pardon?
So Harvard University still has a mandating their students to be vaccinated. And most of them already have COVID, so they don't need it. But even if those who doesn't have it, they have such small risk from COVID that those mandates doesn't make any sense at all. It's very unscientific and very unethical.
Wow. Yeah. But the irony is that you work at Harvard University. They should be picking up the extension line and giving you a call and asking, does this make any sense? But obviously they're not doing that.
Well, I don't work for Harvard anymore, but they're still welcome to call me if they want to, but they won't. So
Okay. Well, this is just stunning. I can't believe that there are these institutions again mandating that for students of all things. So this is really truly remarkable. So related to this story, though, is in Canada, we've had Health Canada recognize that there's DNA within the vaccine. So is this a problem? Is there anything that you can offer insight there?
So that's outside my area of expertise. So I know about epidemiology and how to analyze studies, how to design studies, and look at the population level and the clinical levels for these studies, whether it's clinical trials, observational studies. But I don't know the virology or the microbiology of these things. So other people will have to respond to that.
Okay, that's great. So, Martin, one of the things that I found very interesting is you've done a lot of analysis about different nations' response to COVID-19, including your home country of Sweden. And you've stated eloquently how Sweden essentially did it right. It wasn't perfect, but the results are in, and it's very powerful. And so within this context, I guess what I'm getting at is the observation that sovereignty matters in the sense that Sweden had the power, the authority as a national government with their team of public health leaders to decide their particular approach to the pandemic. And that is in complete contrast with every other country, including this country, Canada. We have the national authority to be able to make those decisions. But something peculiar has been happening the last 2 years, and that has been the introduction of the World Health Organization mandates regarding so-called pandemic treaties, or in other words, the whole idea that if we sign on as a large international community, we can somehow manage these future pandemics as one body under one kind of global regime, if you will. And I don't actually know the status on Sweden signing on to this, but does this not concern you that all of a sudden we take this one approach mandated from kind of a World Health Organization bureaucracy that in retrospect was utterly a failure?
I think it's a huge concern, that treaty. And it's important that different countries have the ability to do their own thing for two reasons. One is that there are local differences, but the other reason is that then you find out afterwards who did well and who did not. And we need to know that. Mm-hmm. I think the reason why so many politicians were attacking Sweden is that they were afraid, because they did the lockdowns and they were afraid that if Sweden didn't do them and it turned out better, then they would look really bad. They would be embarrassed. And that's exactly what happened.
Right.
So Sweden became like the control group. So that's infutable evidence now that lockdowns did not make sense. But if Sweden had been forced to follow the rest of the world or the European Union, then we wouldn't have had that example.
Yeah.
And I think actually in the U.S. is a strength, because each state has responsibility for public health, so each state can do what they want. They most follow the CDC guidelines or recommendations, but not everybody. South Dakota did not. and Florida did not. So Florida closed down in the spring of 2020, yeah. But then they opened up because the governor realized that that wasn't the right approach. He started to read about public health. And we can compare, for example, Florida and California. California was one of the ones who locked down the worst, but Florida came out better. So,
but I think this is a stunning example, Martin, and it's a very important public policy. You want to devolve power to the most local level possible so that people can make their decisions. So in this example, I think you stated well, Florida went a different way. And the results are, like Sweden, in complete positive contrast with so many other jurisdictions. And so if we just centralize power and authority, we lose the ability to innovate and be able to protect and serve the people. So that, for me, I think is another lesson, is that governance matters here, doesn't it?
I agree. We should have to have a centralized authoritarian bureaucracy is not a good thing. And we knew that. I mean, the Soviet Union was a centralized bureaucracy. It didn't work very well.
Exactly.
And yes. I think that, a centralized bureaucracy is not going to work in other settings either. So,
no, I agree. The other thing, so what I find fascinating about that example is that arguably you have politicians climbing on board these kinds of centralized treaties, so they don't have to worry then that there'll be some kind of differentiated response to an issue, and then that would in turn embarrass them. So yeah, they want to hop onto these treaties so it somehow prevents them from being embarrassed for their response. I mean, this is how corrupt it becomes. Who's serving whom? Are the politicians serving themselves and their reputation, or are they serving the people? This is the kind of other lesson that comes out of this, is it not?
I think so. And I have sympathy for the politicians in the spring of 2020 that they did not necessarily know what to do because they were not experts on epidemiology. But what I don't have sympathy for is, one is, if you are a politician, you should listen to a diverge of views. And then for a few years, this pandemic was the major political issue. So it's the responsibility of the politicians to actually read up on it and try to learn something about infectious diseases and epidemiology. And not just say, I'm going to do like everybody else does.
Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right. And it reminds me of the importance then of how do you make decisions. I think of conversations with our friend and colleague, Dr. William Happer, who's obviously a legend in terms of scientific research, but he would be a big advocate, certainly in his work in defense, of using red-blue exercises, setting up debates. Imagine that, Martin, debates of different perspectives so that you say, well, man, we can actually learn from each other.
Yeah. No, there should have been many of these discussions, and they didn't happen. There were very few happened.
Yeah, so it's really remarkable. And I think another example then coming out of this COVID-19 that is really retrospective and very, very timely has been the whole debate about the origins of COVID-19 vis-a-vis, what is it called again? Oh, yes, the People's Republic of China and the Wuhan lab. Because you recall that there was all kinds of references that somehow this came out of some kind of, some kind of bat soup or something like this, and that somehow it was naturally occurring. I mean, this line was maintained again and again and again. And from the beginning, it came out fairly quickly that, well, it was likely from this unique, one-of-a-kind level 4 lab in China, called the Wuhan lab. So does that all surprise you in retrospect that we have all kinds of receipts and documentation, report after report, confirming that it came from that Wuhan lab?
No, I mean, lab leaks can happen. And I don't think that I'm very skeptical of doing this gain of function research. So, but what's also very concerning, I think, is that obviously, in early 2020, we didn't know. So it could have been from a lab leak, it could have been from a market, it could have been some other naturally occurring things. So we didn't know. But the debate was shut down. Anybody who wanted to explore whether it could have been from the lab was sort of shut down, and that was not allowed. And there was some conspiracy theories.
Yes, so we're to me, conspiracy theorists.
To me, that's very worrying that you can't even discuss these things. So something is decided, and if you want to explore so with an open mind scientifically, then you're being called a conspiracy theorist, and you're being canceled and slandered. And exactly. To me, that's you can't make progress with science that way. And people who, scientists who engage in that activities, they should not be scientists. Maybe they should.
I agree.
Maybe they should be politicians, because that's what they do. Politicians do, but I think politicians shouldn't do that either. So.
Indeed. So speaking of politicians then, and this is all, I think, very related, Martin, is this week in Canada, we had quite a bomb dropped in terms of the whole issue of our level four lab, our national lab based in Winnipeg, where there was a revelation that there was significant leaking going on there. So we'll get to that clip.
This is from government documents, the Trudeau government's own documents. It says, here on page 142, Winnipeg lab scientist Dr. Chu is head of the special pathogens unit, the top person in that job. According to documents on page 242, quote, represents a serious and credible danger to the government of Canada as a whole, and in particular at facilities considered high security due to the potential for theft of dangerous materials attractive to terrorists and foreign entities that conduct espionage to infiltrate and damage the economic security of Canada, end quote. It states further on page 239, investigators assess that Dr. Chu communicated with foreign entities during her trips to China. The evidence obtained from interviews and from information collected from the electronic content of her devices reveal that this is indeed the case. As a subject matter expert with access to sensitive information and dangerous materials, Dr. Chu presents a realistic and credible threat to Canada's economic security when conducting repeated and clandestine meetings with foreign entities, end quote. Then it says Dr. Chu conducted joint research with the Major General Chen Wei of the People's Liberation Army, who, according to page 236, is a noted top virologist at the Academy of Military Medical Sciences and is China's chief biological defense expert engaged in research related to biosafety, biodefense, and bioterrorism.
So that's a stunning revelation, because for years now, our federal government has refused to reveal the information that there was a relationship, a particular relationship between the head of a Canadian lab, this national lab based in Winnipeg, the director of special pathogens, as I recall, and the head of bioterrorism of the People's Liberation Army in China. So perhaps one of the lessons we've learned as well, Martin, is the vulnerability of influence and relationships between our own nations and the work that was going on, obviously, in the Wuhan lab. We know that you referenced the research funding that was from the United States and other intermediaries for gain-of-function research. Maybe you could explain to us what gain-of-function research is really all about.
Well, they again, this is not my area of expertise because it's virology, but they manipulate the viruses so that they will be more enhance their capabilities to, for example, to be infected from one person to another. So and presumably they do it because they do that so that they then can find ways to prevent or to develop vaccines, for example, or to study how they behave. But if there's a lab leak, that can have enormous consequences, of course. So one should not take this type of research very lightly. And I'm not surprised that many governments are involved in this because the military parts of it. But I think that as scientists, I think we should try to stay out of it.
Exactly. So we certainly have learned a lot about, you know, in reflection with you about the dangers of censorship, the need for open debate, particularly when we do science. And I think actually George Bernard Shaw said the first condition of progress is the removal of censorship. So I wanted to share with you this clip that relates to you, Dr. Martin Kulldorff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Twitter files were not just about Hunter Biden's laptop. Twitter files make it apparent Twitter worked overtime to suppress accurate COVID information. Dr. Jay Bhattacharya is a professor of medicine at Stanford who once tweeted an article he wrote about natural immunity. Thanks to Elon Musk's release of the Twitter files, we learned some of his tweets were tagged with the label of Trends Blacklist. Apparently, the views of a Stanford doctor are disinformation to you people. I, along with many Americans, have long-term effects from COVID. Not only was I a long hauler, but I have effects from the vaccine. It wasn't the first shot, but it was the second shot that I now developed asthma that has never gone away since I had the second shot. I have tremors in my left hand, and I have the occasional heart pain that no doctor can explain, and I've had a battery of tests. I find it extremely alarming Twitter's unfettered censorship spread into medical fields and affected millions of Americans by suppressing expert opinions from doctors and censoring those who disagree with the CDC. I have great regrets about getting the shot because of the health issues that I now have that I don't think are ever going to go away. And I know that I'm not the only American who has those kinds of concerns. Another example of what Twitter has done to censor folks is from Dr. Martin Kulldorff, a Harvard-educated epidemiologist, who once tweeted, COVID vaccines are important for high-risk people and their caretakers. Those with prior natural infection do not need it, nor children. The Twitter files reveal this tweet was deemed false information because it ran contrary to the CDC. So my first question this morning of Ms. Gatti, may I ask of you, where did you go to medical school?
I did not go to medical school.
I'm sorry?
I did not go to medical school.
That's what I thought. Why do you think you or anyone else at Twitter had the medical expertise to censor a doctor's expert opinion?
Our policies regarding COVID were designed to protect individuals. We were seeing
things. You guys censored Harvard-educated doctors, Stanford-educated doctors, doctors that are educated in the best places in the world, and you silenced those voices. My next question is, did the U.S. government, I have another chart I want to show you, Ms. Gatti. I have another tweet by someone with a following of a full 18,000 followers. This person put a chart from the CDC on Twitter. It's the CDC's own data, so it's accurate by your standards, and you all labeled this as misleading. You're not a doctor, right, Ms. Gatti?
No, I'm not.
Okay. What makes you think you or anyone else of Twitter have the medical expertise to censor actual, accurate CDC data?
I'm not familiar with these particular situations.
Yeah, I'm sure you're not. But this is what Twitter did. They labeled this as inaccurate. It is the government's own data. It's ridiculous that we're even having to have this conversation today. It's not just about the laptop. This is about medical advice that expert doctors were trying to give Americans because social media companies like Twitter were silencing their voices. I have another question, my last one for you, Ms. Gatti. Did the U.S. government ever contact you or anyone at Twitter to pressure Twitter to moderate or censor certain tweets? Yes or no?
We have a program.
Did the U.S. government ever contact you or anyone at Twitter to censor or moderate certain tweets? Yes or no?
We receive legal demands to remove content from the platform from the U.S. government and governments all around the world. Those are published on a third-party website, and anyone can review
them. Thank God for Matt Taibbi. Thank God for Elon Musk for allowing to show us in the world that Twitter was basically a subsidiary of the FBI, censoring real medical voices with real expertise that put real Americans' lives in danger because they didn't have that information. I also want to thank one of my colleagues, Ro Khanna, because as it turns out, censorship isn't just an important issue to conservatives. Some of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, like Ro, found this censorship very concerning, and even wrote to you and to folks at Twitter that he was concerned about the First Amendment being censored. So I want to thank him for speaking up and speaking out about this issue, because this should not be a partisan issue. This should be an issue that's an American issue. Mr. Chairman, I would like to enter into the record. I ask unanimous consent to enter into the record a Wall Street Journal article from December 9th, 2022 by Justin Hart entitled "The Twitter Blacklisting of Jay Bhattacharya." Enter the record, please, Mr. Chairman.
Without objection, so ordered.
Thank you, and I yield back.
Well, there you have it. It's quite a powerful clip. And what's fascinating, there's a couple things, one of which is that Congresswoman Nancy Mace eloquently goes through that background and information. And that was about a year ago. And what's interesting is behind her is a listing of responses from Dr. Martin Kolder. So when they were talking about people censored, that included Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, of course, our friend, but you, Dr. Martin Kolder. So how do you look at that, looking back from about a year ago now?
Well, I was censored multiple times by Twitter, by LinkedIn, YouTube, which is owned by Google. LinkedIn is owned by Microsoft and also by Facebook. So if you had told me 5 years ago that I would, as a scientist, be censored for saying scientific truths, I would have laughed at you and thought you were not a conspiracy theorist.
Exactly.
I could never have imagined this would happen, and I think it's shocking. And it's very bad for, not just for the pandemic, I think it's bad for society as a whole, for other things. And
indeed.
I would also say that when the First Amendment was, when the U.S. got its First Amendment of freedom of speech, that was after a very turbulent time, a crisis, because it was during the War of Independence, after the War of Independence. Yeah. So those who wrote that, they realized that it's especially when you have a crisis that freedom of speech is important. So it was especially important to value freedom of speech during the pandemic. That's when it's most important to safeguard it. So this idea that we can have it when everything is fine, but when there's a problem, we have to take it down. Well, I guess that's an opinion for authoritarian politician who doesn't want their thoughts to be questioned. But who doesn't have the capacity to argue. So if somebody doesn't have, if somebody can argue for their stance, they will do so, and they can do so. But if they can't, they will have to either use silencing and censoring, or they have to use slander and canceling. Those are the only two things that are available to them.
Well said. No, I think you make a very powerful point that freedom of speech matters. It's critical to have healthy debate in a society. Well said. So in this context,
the only thing that I would disagree with Representative Nancy Mace is that I think she has far too high opinion about Harvard and Stanford.
Okay, indeed.
That's the only thing I disagree with her on.
Yeah, so that is the irony, is that we also have institutions, and I think post the October 7th terrorist attacks by Hamas on Israel, we saw the testimony from the heads of those institutions come forward, and gosh, yeah, to what extent they have freedom of speech is really a good question. So that testimony, though, it's very also interesting. It was a year ago, and we've learned a lot since then. Because, it's like being in a room and you only see part of the elephant. And now we're seeing a bigger picture. And that is the revelations that just came out about a month ago, confirming that there have been some 67 U.S. agencies also linked to the Five Eyes intelligence agreement, including the United States, New Zealand, Australia, United States, of course, and Canada. So the level of censorship here matters, and that in the particular example of the United States, there were 67 agencies systematically directing those social media companies. Because I think for a number of years we thought, well, is Twitter just, you know, really biased and systematically censoring any kind of comment? Well, no, it was actually much worse than that. You had agencies from the government behind the scenes clearly directing them under penalty of law that they would lose their license. So they had to comply in order to survive. So I think that is a totally new revelation. And so not to be outdone, we have a situation in this country, in Canada, where this week our federal government introduced online censorship bills, legal legislation that will, if passed, censor all kinds of things on our internet. It's a full frontal attack on freedom of speech. There will be penalties, both financially for social media companies. Does this sound familiar? But also jail time, including life sentences to people that are deemed to be infracting this kind of law. This is very, very disturbing. And so how do we do science, Dr. Kaldorf? How do we do science, open discussion, and search for the truth if everywhere you turn, you think that someone could sue you and legally attack you and put you in jail if you can't seek the truth?
We don't. We can't. It's concerning for science, but I think it's also a concern for the whole society. In the United States, we have a lawsuit. It's called Missouri versus Biden, where I am one of the plaintiffs. Yes. So with the attorney generals of Missouri and Louisiana, together with myself, Dr. J. Barashaya, Aaron Criati, Jill Hines, and Jim Hoft, we have sued the federal government. So it's Biden and his official capacity as president, but also another, yes, many other named agencies like CDC, FBI, and so on. And we are basically saying that you have to stop pressuring social media companies to do the kind of censoring that you have been engaged in. And we received a temporary injunction against the government in the federal court, in the district court in Louisiana. And then I think it was in August last year that the federal government appealed it. So I think it was around August that we won again in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeal. And now it's they appealed that to the Supreme Court. So that's now being heard in the Supreme Court. And we have the oral arguments on March 18. So just 2-3 weeks from now. And I think it's the most important First Amendment free speech case in the U.S. In a long, long time.
Indeed. So bravo on you, to you, Martin, and other colleagues like Dr. J. Bhattacharya, and of course the Attorney General of Missouri, for taking on that case regarding the First Amendment for freedom of speech. So you're on the front line of this, moving this agenda forward, because you were vilified, attacked. It was just really pathetic how you were persecuted for speaking really basic truths and opinions regarding health that mattered in people's lives. So it's
important to realize also that this lawsuit is not only because the federal government did something to me and those others who were censored. It's actually even more important. The citizens of Missouri and the citizens of Louisiana, they were deprived from hearing things about the pandemic that they have a right to hear.
Exactly.
So when somebody is censored, it's not always the person who's being censored that's the major victim. The major victim is the people who can't hear what they want to hear, what they need to hear.
Right. And so in the Canadian context, we've actually had physician groups, dare I say, cutouts, basically kind of proxies for different governments that would actually, they actually threatened or undertook legal action against others who said, no, this is not correct in terms of the management of COVID-19. So they were threatened and even attacked by those groups. So now in Canada, if you introduce that kind of online censorship bill, you basically give them a weapon to go after anyone else who disagrees with them. That's my take on it, as well as the Canadian Civil Liberties Association, among so many others. So this is a very important time in the life of our country, let alone Western countries, including the United States, for really what you refer to as the Enlightenment. I know you've spoken eloquently about protecting that, but that's the context in which we face now, is it not, Martin?
Yes, if we don't have freedom of speech, the age of Enlightenment is over. And we had it for a few hundred years, but that will be it. So I think we have to fight to try to keep it. There's no more important fight than to fight for freedom of speech, I think.
Really is.
Because every other fight depends on that.
As we kind of wind up our discussion, we've certainly had a very far-reaching discussion. There are some green shoots of hope. There's signs of renewal. You certainly mentioned the First Amendment speech that's going case that's going to the Supreme Court of the United States that you're involved with. In Canada, we've had a number of cases now where there are physicians who were once ticketed or under threat of losing their license by the College of Physicians that are now having those decisions overturned. I think of Dr. Kulvinder Gill, who's a pediatric allergist in Toronto, who
very brave physicians who spoke up during the pandemic. Enormous admiration for her.
So I think, what are other signs that of hope that you're seeing, Martin, as you see people become more aware of these issues and speak up?
I think the biggest positive sign is in the population at large, who are more and more people understanding it. More and more people are understanding that what a disaster the pandemic response was. More and more people are concerned about our democracy and freedom of speech. And that's the only thing that's going to change it, because the rulers are not going to change things voluntarily. They prefer to do it to sort of, you know, they feel threatened. And it's when they feel threatened that they institute this censorship regime. If they weren't threatened, they wouldn't need it. So the fact that they're doing it is actually a sign that they feel threatened. And I'm glad they are threatened, and we have to continue to make them feel uncomfortable, make sure that we can keep freedom of speech and that we can keep society and our civilization.
Well said, Dr. Martin Kulvinder, and I want to thank you for all your leadership and your courage and for having this far-reaching discussion today with us.
Thank you very much. It was a great pleasure talking to you, and thank you for all the work you're doing. It's so important.
Thank you.
Thank you for watching Leaders on the Frontier. We're a nonpartisan think tank. We explore ideas, policy, and practical solutions that can make a difference in the lives of Canadians. We do not accept any government funding. We work for you. Thank you for supporting Frontier. Visit fcpp.org to give. While you're there, be sure to check out our latest articles and research. Without open discussion and debate, you're not thinking, nor are you free. Comment below. We'd love for you to join the conversation.